Daniel 8. Another vision. This whole section, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, these visions, these dreams. And we're in probably what most consider the most difficult part of the book of Daniel. They're not straight stories like the first six chapters. These visions, these dreams, although chapter 8 is a little more straightforward than chapter 7 was. Chapter 8 is a little more straightforward. Remember, we talked about history and understanding history, not spinning out of control, not going, you know, just out there spinning and not having any purpose or any direction. That's not the way we look at history. That's not the way within the Christian worldview we look at history. We look at history as having a beginning and an end. It's linear. It's going somewhere. It has purpose. It has design. So it started somewhere and it will end somewhere. And the watershed event of all of that, of course, is the cross, the death, burial, resurrection of Christ. Now, if we probe a little further in that understanding of history, then we know, because we read it in history books, we read it in the Bible, we know that within history, some horrible things have happened. Horrible things. Human evil displayed, abuse, tyrants. We read about it in the history books, and we also see, sometimes we see it in Scripture. Now, this is true individually. This is true of our lives individually. Some horrible things sometimes happen. We get sick. We have terrible things happen. We lose a job. We have a marriage that breaks up. We have financial issues. We have, you know, trouble at work. All these things, individually, this is true. Sometimes terrible things happen. Sometimes horrible things happen. And yes, they do sometimes happen to God's people. Remember Job? They do sometimes happen to God's people. We're not immune. We live in a fallen world. We live in a fallen world. But then also, as we look at history, we probe this a little further. Some horrible things have happened in a collective sense. There have been some horrible rulers. There have been some horrible governments. We see some of that today. We see some horrible movements that have happened even just within the last few years, right? ISIS. The horror of what they did as they swept through parts of the Middle East. We've seen communism. We see other places in the world even today where just terrible, horrible things are happening. And yes, some of those things are happening to God's people. Some of those things are happening to people that love Christ and are following Him, and they're swept up into that. So, is God nothing more? Is He nothing more than some cruel tyrant playing with us? Is He nothing more than just some God who gets His kicks out of watching horror and abuse, and just watching people react to it and just see. I wonder if they can take this and unleashes something. There are some people that view God that way. In fact, it's one of the reasons why some people will give that they can't believe in a God who would allow these horrible things to happen. They can't believe in a God who would allow these things to happen to innocent people. Or God's just an absentee landlord. God just put things into motion and He's letting it go and He's up there. And one day, maybe He'll get involved. But as of right now, He's just letting it run its course. And what we see, the horror and the evil that we see are just sort of, you know, it's just sort of the nature of things. And it's just the way things are going. And then at some point, He might step in. Well, when we try to make sense of the world, we're trying to think through this. And these are legitimate issues. These are legitimate questions that people have. And there are, if you talk to people who do not believe in the Christian worldview, do not believe the gospel, do not have much good thoughts about God at all, these are issues they're going to throw up. They throw them up and they say, how in the world can you believe in a God who would let these horrible things happen? Doesn't it bother you? Yes, it bothers me. Yes, it bothers me, especially when I can't seem to make sense of it in my own mind. It bothers me. But it doesn't shake my faith and trust and confidence in God. Because I know He is good. And I know in His purpose and His design and in His providence the way things are ordered and structured, that He's working all things to good for those that love Christ and are called to His purpose. And I know He's going to bring it to an end. So, as we try to make sense of this, there are three really questions that we need to think about and wrestle with in our mind. The first one is, where did it all start? How did it all get here? I mean, are we accidents? Chance? Luck of the draw? Fate? Is that it? Where did it all start? Well, we know the Bible tells us God created the heavens and the earth. God created everything. God's the creator. The second thing in our minds as we look at it and we try to make sense of this world is, what went wrong? If God created everything perfect, what went wrong? How did it get to this point? How is it that we see these cycles in history of horror and evil and abuse? Well, sin. Man rebelled against the Creator. Sin enters the picture. Sin enters in. God didn't cause it. We rebelled. And as a result of that, sin enters the picture and we live in a fallen world. How do we fix it? Right? How are we going to fix it? Well, guess what? We don't fix it. We've tried, and we don't fix it. God alone is the one who will fix it. God alone is the one who provides salvation and redemption. And we don't have time to go through the whole history of that, but from the fall and the planning and bringing the Messiah and Christ dying, His death, burial, resurrection, and salvation in Him and redemption, He's restoring, making all things new. And in the end, it will be made all new. In the end, it will end in a judgment. And God will set things right. We go into eternity with Him. Those are three issues. Whether or not you realize it or not, you may not put them in those exact words. But trust me, all of us at some point have sat and wondered, is this all there is to it? Is this all there is to it? Is this all I have to look forward to? Is this it? Especially when times are bad. So then, our hope is not in fate, our hope is not in chance, our hope is not in the luck of the draw, our hope is not in man's abilities, although in God's common grace, man's doing some pretty incredible stuff. Right, Mark? I mean, you just experienced some of the medical marvels of what's happening. And that's by God's common grace. But our hope is not in that. It's not. Our hope is in a sovereign God who created everything, who sustains everything in His providence, whose purposes are sometimes hidden to us and we can't see and fully understand everything He's up to and what He's doing. Sometimes those purposes are hidden from us, but He calls us to a life of faith and trust. And what we must do is live the gospel every day, regardless of the circumstances. That's it. That's what a life of faith is. Daniel 8, once again, we see the sovereignty of God. In fact, this is the theme of the whole book, really, if you want to sum it up. It's the sovereignty of God, and He controls all things. He controls all these kingdoms. He controls all this, not just the external things, but God even controls the thoughts, the ideas. He's sovereign over all of this. No matter how dark, no matter how horrible it looks, we've seen some horrible things, and we're going to see a horrible thing in Daniel 8. We're going to approach Daniel 8 the same way we did Daniel 7, sort of following an inductive Bible study. First thing, we're going to observe, what does it say? Second thing, we're going to say, what does it mean? We're going to try to interpret it, because it's interpreted for Daniel. And then the third thing is that we're going to apply it. What does it mean for us today? How do I live this tomorrow? How do I go out, take Daniel 8 and live it tomorrow? Right? Because if we can't get there, then this is just a mere academic exercise. And it can't be that. God's Word can't be just that academic exercise. Daniel 8 is about 2 years after Daniel 7. We're still in the reign of Belshazzar. In fact, it says in verse 1, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. So we go back again to Belshazzar about 14 years after chapter 6. So chapter 8, somewhere about 12 years after chapter 6. We've already seen some of the main players that we'll see here in chapter 8. It's as if Daniel, this dream, this vision, his focus is narrowed on two particular kingdoms. But we've already been introduced to them. In chapter 2, we were introduced to them with the great statue. Nebuchadnezzar has the dream, the statue. Daniel comes and interprets the statue. And he talks about this chapter 8 is going to focus on the middle two sections of the statue, Persia and Greece. We saw it in chapter 7 again with these hybrid animals, these weird looking animals, the middle two animals, the middle two kingdoms, again, Persia and Greece. Although chapter 8, we don't see this weird hybrid animal-human mix. They're pretty straightforward. But they are interpreted. They are interpreted for Daniel. And Daniel's told, this is Persia and this is Greece. And that's who this deals with. So let's observe, what does it actually say? Well, the first two verses set the stage. In verse 1, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me. Chapter 7, more of a dream. Here he says, vision. A vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. Must be a reference to chapter 7. He has the first one there. Now, about 2 years later, this vision appears. And I saw in the vision, and it so happened, while I was looking, that I was in Shushan, Susa, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was by the river Ulai. So here's the setting. He's in this canal that connected two rivers that emptied into the Persian Gulf. He sees himself in Susa, which was eventually one of the leading cities of Persia. This is the house of where the kings would spend the winter. It's a prominent city. And it doesn't appear, the language does not appear that he was actually there physically, but in the vision he went there. So that's the setting. He has this vision. This is where he's at. And in verse 3, here's the actual vision. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. Remember chapter 7, the bear? Remember he said in chapter 7, the bear, but was leaning up on one side? He was leaning up on one side. So it may be that here, this ram that he sees, the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. Maybe indicating one stronger. But let's stay with observation. What does it actually say? One was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward. Westward, northward, southward. You see which direction is left out? East. So this ram's pushing so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. So he sees this ram, these two horns, one a little higher, one comes up later, and this ram is just bulldozing, just going. Take him. No one can stop him. He does what he wants. Then verse 5. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. Without touching the ground has the idea of it must have been swift. You ever been speeding in a car and you ever jumped in a car and said, man, we only going to touch the high places. You know what that means? You're going so fast, if there's any invention, you're not even, right? That's what he's saying about this goat. This goat came through so swift, without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes.
Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran into him with furious power. The goat was enraged at the ram. So he runs into him, and I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him. But he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore, the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. We've already seen winds of heaven before. And out of one of them came a little horn. Now, this should remind us of seven. The whole focus of chapter 7 was this little horn. But there's a difference. The little horn of 7 came out of Rome. And as we dealt with 7, it was clearly what it was portraying was the coming of the Antichrist. This little horn comes out of Greece, not Rome. It's not the Antichrist, but may very well be a type of the Antichrist to come. So, this great horn breaks, four notable ones come up, four other horns, and out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. I'll go ahead and give you a hint as we get to interpretation later, but the glorious land is Israel. The glorious land is Jerusalem. So he goes south, east, and he marches on Jerusalem. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Host of heaven here being the stars. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. Now this is a name for God. So this little horn is exalting himself as high as God. And by him, the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down because of transgression. An army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. He did all of this destruction and abuse, and he prospered. He grew stronger and stronger and stronger. And then, verse 13, then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long is this abuse going to happen? How long is this going to go on? How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the abomination of desolation? The giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot. And then he said to me, for 2,300 days and the sanctuary shall be cleansed. We'll come back to the 2,300 days in just a minute. That's the vision. Man, he sees this ram, powerful, then a goat, powerful, takes down the ram, horn of the goat breaks, four come up, the little horn, this little horn is horrible, terrible, horrible. And he goes after God's people. He goes after them, and there's a cry that goes up, how long? The implication is, this cry goes to God, how long are you going to allow this to happen? What a vision, right? Well, if we were just left with that, man, we'd be scratching our head trying to figure out what in the world. But there's interpretation. It's just like Daniel 7. There was an interpreter in Daniel 7. Daniel gets the dream, gets the vision. I'm sure in his mind at this point he's thinking, what in the world? And then he seeks to understand. That's what we see in verse 15 as we get to the interpretation. Then it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was speaking the meaning and seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. This voice obviously is God. And God says to Gabriel, Gabriel, go to Daniel and help him understand what he just saw. The ultimate interpreter here is God himself. In His grace, He's allowing Daniel to have some insight into what all of this means. So, verse 17, "So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, 'Understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end.'" Now, I have to say this about the end, because some take end here to mean the very end, the ultimate end, the second coming of Christ. I don't think that's the end here. I think the end is whatever he sees happening with the little horn in the second century B.C. That's going to come to an end. Now, all of this has implications for the future. All of it is sort of a type, a shadow of what will happen in the future. So I think that's the end that he's talking about. When will this happen? When will this come to an end? And God tells Gabriel, "You take Daniel, help him understand." Daniel is afraid. He falls on his face. Gabriel says, no, understand this. Understand what this is about. And in verse 18, "Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright." He stood me upright. I can almost hear Gabriel saying to Daniel, "You ready? You ready for this? You sure you want to see this? You sure you want to understand this?" Daniel probably with knocking knees and a quivering lip. "I want to understand." "Buckle up, Daniel. You think in the dream in chapter 7 you saw the horror of human evil? Daniel, you haven't seen anything yet. So here we go." Verse 19. "And he said, 'Look, I'm making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation.'" This is not a time of peace. "For at the appointed time," hang on to that language, "at the appointed time the end shall be. The ram which you saw having two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia." So the ram is Persia, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. "The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king." Who was the first great king of Greece? Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great. He is the goat. The ram is Persia. These are the middle two kingdoms of the chapter 2 dream and the chapter 7 dream. Babylon and Rome are the bookends. In between this historical time period, there's Persia and Greece. The Persians under Cyrus controlled the world. They took the world. And then Alexander the Great, by the time he was like 26 years old, had conquered the known world. Alexander the Great did it with such speed. He was so fast and so swift. They say that literally that he conquered territories so fast that they got into areas they didn't even have maps. And he had to have map makers with him. That's how fast he ran through the known world at the time. Conquers, takes Persia. 331 B.C. defeats Darius, defeats Persia. Alexander the great conqueror. History books are full of his exploits. Marvelous, wonderful general. Great military man. And then all of a sudden, at about the age 33, he dies suddenly. He dies suddenly. He had two sons. One was born actually 3 months after his death. His political enemies murder his two sons. His kingdom, Greece, is divided into four parts. The one horn is broken. Four rise up. Greece was divided into four parts. They were controlled. Each part of Greece was controlled by one of his generals. In the midst of all that, all of a sudden, we go from Alexander the Great, and this vision skips about two centuries. Because all of a sudden, we jump to the middle of the second century B.C., because this is when this little horn comes on the scene. Who's the little horn? His name was Antiochus the Fourth. You may have heard him by the name Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes was not a name he took. He was given the title Epiphanes, which means basically God, in a sense, God revealed. And he elevated himself into this godlike, tyrant, abusive ruler. Antiochus comes to power in about 175 B.C. Antiochus, through political maneuverings and so forth, gains the throne. And this is a fascinating period of history there with Greece, and Rome is on the rise. Antiochus is trying to follow Alexander the Great's vision of what was known as Hellenization. Now, what was that? Hellenization was this. And Alexander the Great wasn't even Greek. He was a Macedonian. But he loved the Greek way of life. Hellenization was the world under his... As he conquered the world, we're going to think like Greeks, act like Greeks, and live like Greeks. That, in a sense, was Hellenization. Antiochus wants to do the same thing. Now, again, we're a couple of hundred years removed from Alexander. And there had been political maneuvering with the Jews in Palestine and Jerusalem, and there were some Jews who said, great, let's welcome it, let's do it. I mean, after all, when in Rome, do as the Romans, right? And so they did. They tried to make friends with the Greeks and Antiochus. There were others who said, no, we will not go this far. And they drew a line in the sand, and it ticked Antiochus off. And Antiochus saw these Orthodox Jews as roadblocks to his plan to Hellenize the world. And what did he do? He went after them. Now, if the wheels are turning, and you're thinking, and you hear the term, you may not hear the term Hellenization today, but there's another term that's being used. Secularization. Secularization. There are people dead set on secularizing this nation. Right? And who stands in the way? Bible-believing Christians. Bible-believing Christians. So Antiochus goes and his abuse. We know this history from some intertestament books, the Maccabees. And we get this history from that. And so there's some of the things that Antiochus did. The Jews didn't call him Epiphanes. The Jews called him Epinomes, which meant madman. Madman. He strolls into Jerusalem, he stops the sacrifices, sets up statues of the pagan gods, the Greek gods, and he goes to Egypt. He's going to take care of the Egyptians, but he's stopped in Egypt by Rome because Rome's rising, and they stop. There's rumors that he's dead. The Jews figure, okay, he's dead. Let's try to gain back control of Jerusalem. He had taken the high priest and had removed him, and through political maneuvering had maneuvered his own guy as high priest, who was giving him money and loving him. And the Jews hated this new high priest. And they figure he's dead. Let's try to bring back and let's try to gain back control of the high priesthood and Jerusalem. And Antiochus wasn't dead. And he takes it as rebellion. And guess what he did? He sent one of his generals into Jerusalem. On one Sabbath day, they slaughtered 20,000 Jews. In a 3-day period, they executed 40,000 Jews. It was a bloodbath. He strolls into the temple and he slaughters a pig on the altar as if to say, your God's conquered. We've seen this earlier, right, with Nebuchadnezzar. As if to say, this is what I think about your God. It became known as what was called the abomination of desolation. That's what Antiochus did. Daniel's going to mention it in chapter 11. In Matthew chapter 24, Jesus mentions that abomination of desolation. And it is a type. Now, Antiochus is a type, a foreshadow of the little horn of chapter 7, the Antichrist that's to come. He's going to have some of these same characteristics and do some of these same things, but this is localized in Jerusalem. Antiochus dies suddenly. I think he was on his way back on his way out of Palestine. He dies suddenly. And this is what we see. Now follow along with the interpretation. After he says the ram was Persia, the male goat is Greece. Verse 22, as for the broken horn and the four that stood in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation. But not with its power. They weren't as great as Alexander. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce feature, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even raise against the prince of princes. He's even going to set himself against God. This is Antiochus. Horrible. Abusive. Tyrant. And this is what he's going to do. But then you notice at the end of verse 25, that he shall be broken without human hands. He died suddenly of natural causes. He wasn't killed in battle. He died suddenly of natural causes. Without human hand. Guess who was behind it? Our God. Without human hand. Verse 26, and the vision in the evenings and mornings which was told is true. Therefore seal up the visions, for it refers to many days in the future. Now, what about the 2300? Because how long will this happen? I mean, this was about a 6-year period of history. So is the 2300 morning and evenings, 2300 days, which would be a little over 6 years, possibly. Or it could be 1150 days, which was a little over 3 years, because it was morning and evening sacrifices being one day. I don't know. Or is it some symbolic number? I don't know. Both 6 years and 3 years fit within the time period. Both fit within that time period. Then notice how it ends in verse 27. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I rose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. It so shook Daniel that he's sick for days. Then notice, after that, he got up and went about his business. He got up. He went about his business. So, there's the observation. The interpretation of this. Who is this dealing with? It's dealing with Persia and Greece. That little horn that is so focused on is Antiochus Epiphanes. Horrible, horrible tyrant. So what about application? What do we see in this that helps me today? And especially, we could talk about, given our circumstances and what's happening on the world scene, not only what's happening on the world scene, but what's happening in this nation. What's happening here? History is filled with tyrants. We're about to celebrate the 4th of July, aren't we? I mean, this week we're going to celebrate the 4th of July. It's a glorious occasion, and it's a time in which we celebrate, you know, the birth of this nation and the freedom that we have. And I'm so thankful to God that we live in a land of freedom so that we can gather like this on the Lord's Day like this, right? So that we can worship. At least now we can worship and read our Bibles and follow Christ, and although it's becoming increasingly difficult to do that. But aren't you thankful for this country? Aren't you thankful for the freedom? This grand experiment that was started by our founding fathers, taking Western freedom to a new level. I mean, they had had freedom. They had had somewhat freedom, you know, in England and places like that, and Western ideas, but our founding fathers took that Western freedom and took it to a new level in order to form a more perfect union. Despite what a recent Democratic candidate said, it is not about bringing LGBTQ and the rest of the nation together. That's not forming a more perfect union. What they meant were things like limited government, separation of powers, and a pursuit of freedom that had never been seen in the world before. I fear we're losing it, and we're losing it rapidly. Our freedom has led us to become a nation of addicts. And we are addicted to everything. We're addicted to everything. I don't think that was God's intention for freedom. I think it was in freedom to love Him and follow Him and to love our neighbor. Well, that's a whole different study. The world, the history of the world really is dominated not by freedom. In fact, the history of the world today is not one of freedom. It's one of tyrants. But who's in control of this? Remember verse 19? And he said, "Look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation. For at the appointed time the end shall be." Who was in control? Not Antiochus. Who's in control? Not the pagans. Who's in control? Not those who are so filled with hatred toward Christ and His Word and the Gospel today. They're not in control. Our sovereign God is in control. Now we've seen this time and time again. Verse 23. "And in the latter time their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, someone steps in. A king shall arise and Antiochus comes in." Again, the idea here of control. Verse 25. "But he shall be broken without human means." Our sovereign God is in control. Evil sometimes prospers. You realize that? I'm not naive. It prospers sometimes. It is prospering in places in the world today. It is. But evil always oversteps. Antiochus went to the point of challenging God. Nebuchadnezzar did the same thing earlier. Remember what happened to him? These people that are opposed to the gospel today, that are running wild, and it seems like they have the upper hand, and it seems like the whole country's following after them, and the whole world's going this way. Listen, eventually they will overstep. Eventually God will bring it to an end. Our God is in control. Live your life in this assurance. He is in control. We could bring it down to an individual level. You have a tyrant boss. They're not in control. You have a tyrant husband. He's not in control. Tyrant wife. They're not in control. You have a sickness. You have an incurable disease. It's not in control. Our sovereign God is in control. And so it's a life of faith. And He always restores. Deuteronomy, He restores. Joshua, He restores. Job, He restores. Here's the other thing, verse 26. "And the vision of the evenings and mornings which was told is true." God's word is true. This vision, Daniel, is true. It's going to happen. God's word is true. John 17. "Sanctify them by your word." Your word is truth. It is true. Psalm 119. That whole long psalm about the word of God. He is faithful to His word. His word is true. If He says this, it will happen. If He says that He loves you, He loves you. How do I know that? Look at the cross. Look at the cross. His word is true. But here's the most amazing thing to me out of this about Daniel, and it's in verse 27. And it's that I have to live in the gospel every day. You notice what happened, verse 27? "And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days." I don't think he had the flu. He was shaken to his core by what he saw. And it wasn't because it was going to happen. I think what shook Daniel was the fact that his God would allow this to happen. That may be what shook him. How can I believe in a God who would allow this? And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I love that. I was shaken to my core. And after I came to my senses, and I'm sure through much prayer, much meditation, probably poring over Jeremiah and the promises of Jeremiah that this was going to end one day in the 70 years and trying to understand about the captivity and the restoration, I'm sure after days of poring over all of that, it soon dawned by God's grace on Daniel, Daniel, get up and live a life of faith. And quit whining and complaining. And quit feeling sorry for yourself. If you trust Him, trust Him. Daniel got up. Went about the king's business. He says, I was astonished by the vision. No one understood it. You know what echoes in my ear here is Paul in Philippians chapter 1 when he says, amidst all sorts of circumstances, doesn't matter, good, bad, death, life, it doesn't matter. In the midst of all sorts of circumstances that life can throw, for me to live is Christ. And to die is gain. For me to live is Christ. Not as long as it's pleasant, easy, peaceful, and no problems. Anybody can do that. Or let me say this, anybody can fake that. Let it get hard. Let it get tough. Let something rip your heart out. And then say, for me to live is Christ. It's living the gospel. It's living in the gospel. John Wesley was asked one time, actually on two different occasions, sort of asked the same question or similar question. One time he was asked, you know, Mr. Wesley, what would you do if you knew that you were going to die tonight at midnight? Wesley said, I'd go home. I'd eat supper. I'd preach the evening service. And I'd go to bed. You get his point? I am living for Christ. He was asked on another occasion, Mr. Wesley, what would you do if you knew that Christ was going to return at 12 noon the next day? It said that Wesley pulled out his calendar. Well, whatever he had. And, you know, he didn't pull out his phone. He didn't go to Google Calendar or anything like that. However he kept up with his appointments, he pulled this out. And he looked at it and he started listing and started rattling off. I preach here. I do this. I will do this. I will do that. And it said that Wesley said at the end of going through his schedule, he said, I want to be found doing what my master called me to do. That's Daniel. I don't get it. I don't understand it. It's shaking me to my core. But you know what? I'm just going to get up and I'm going to live a life of faith. I don't get a lot about what's happening in this life. I don't get a lot about what's happening in our culture. I try to understand it, but I don't always understand it. I'm just going to get up every day and I'm going to live. And for me to live is Christ. Is it perfect? No. Do I mess up? Yes. Do I make mistakes? Yes. Every day. It's not about pursuing for perfection. It's about pursuing Christ. What if you knew you would die tonight at midnight? What What if I knew? I'm afraid I'd probably go start confessing and doing and trying to. If I knew he was coming back tomorrow at noon, I'd probably just say, oh my gosh, I've got, you know. No, we should so live in the gospel that if it did happen, he's going to find us faithful with what he's called us to do. Now I'll close with this. You can't live what you don't have. You may think you have it. There was a period in my life when I thought I had it. And I didn't. I thought I was saved because I quit a bunch of stuff. I thought I was saved because I started going to church. I thought I was saved because I stopped trying to be the person that I used to be. It was not very nice. I thought I was saved because I was baptized. I thought I was saved because of all these things. And then in God's grace, He showed me Christ. And I threw all of that away. And I said, give me Christ. And then guess what? I was changed. Truly changed. Truly changed. Then I became, still in the process of living for Christ. You can't live what you don't have. And you can have it if you turn to Christ. He died, was buried, and raised the third day. And He says, come. Come. Let's pray together.